Today's high 26. Normal high this time of year is 32. The current numbers, wind northwest at 5, 14 degrees Kenosha, 13 Racine, wind chill minus 10. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Next week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, January 14th, 15th, and 16th, an amazing event open to the public is going to be unfolding on the campus of Carthage College, the Third Arts Symposium, celebrating Carthage's Samuel and Barry Schoen collection of Soviet art. And this year's event, titled Peace Parody, A New Cold War. Joining me today on the morning show are four members of the Carthage faculty involved in one way or another with this year's art symposium. Leslie Brothers, visiting assistant professor and current manager of gallery programs at Carthage, the primary coordinator of this year's symposium. Also Richard Meyer, professor of English and writer in residence at Carthage. Joshua McGowan, assistant professor of art who specializes in photography and animation. And Gary Keller, associate professor of marketing and management. The first art symposium at Carthage, the year before last, was titled Beauty and Expression, and it was really designed to introduce the Carthage community and the wider community to the Samuel and Barry Schoen collection of Soviet-era art, a collection of 131 pieces, mostly paintings, dating from the late 19th century to the 1990s, so roughly spanning one century, with artists from not only Russia, but also places like Armenia, Ukraine, Belarus, and so on, with 20 to 30 works put on display in the Johnson Art Gallery. And there were other events as well, representing multiple departments at Carthage. Leslie Brothers was around to help coordinate last year's art symposium, the second such event.
Last year, From Canvas to Cosmos, was really part of my thinking was to try to engage as many faculty from different divisions on campus as a way to help people understand that there are lots of lines that can be drawn to this collection, and that if it seems like something, you know, more obscure or lesser known, I wanted to show that we, within that 100-year arc of history, we could make many connections to what, you know, matters to people today and to what we're discussing with our students in the classroom. And so From Canvas to Cosmos had a kind of a focus, at least the roundtable focus, on the new space race. And there was a lovely exhibition curated by Peter Miller called Place Trace. It was a selection of landscapes, so kind of showing us the presence of absence in these works. And we had a screening of Tarkovsky's film Solaris. So we had a little sci-fi added to it, and there was a lot of discussion and a lot of excitement around that. We were very surprised with a special visit from Esther Sternberg, who gave a talk on the science of beautiful spaces, which was a recent publication of hers, and then the New Space Race Roundtable discussion, which featured a number of faculty connected to our NASA program, physics, biology, and it was just a fabulous, fabulous discussion. So that that symposium kind of led to, which I think people will understand, kind of naturally, peace parody, a new Cold War, navigating global dynamics in the 21st century, which is our third art symposium celebrating the collection. And the theme kind of grew out of the connection that the space race had to the Cold War. And in all the things that I was reading, I kept coming across articles, books, podcasts that asked the question, you know, are we now entering a new Cold War? And overall, it seemed like a great opportunity to discuss why that might be true, and even more so, why not? And I could not have foreseen 9 months ago how our geopolitical landscape would change and how relevant and important these questions would become. Mm. And they are questions in the title. So it's peace, parity, a new Cold War, question mark. Mm. So again, we're looking at significant historical events within this 100-year arc of history that resonate within what is relevant today and what matters to people.
I'm curious to know how these elements, which we'll explore in turn, how they took shape versus the coming aboard of the various participants, several of whom we're going to hear from very, very shortly. Leslie, did you come up with these elements yourself and then find people who could, in a sense, serve those specific events within the symposium? Or was it a little more collaborative in terms of shaping the symposium and how best to kind of explore this theme from these various perspectives?
Always collaborative. So, Greg, you know, Carthage is full of really super talented and interesting faculty and staff, and I'm in the second year of getting to know them. So in fact, when I was going through my notes, I found my list of names, so I kind of I look everybody up online, and the people I don't know, and imagine that, you know, for whatever reason, their research, what their PhD was focused on, or what they're teaching. I ask myself if they might be interested in participating in the symposium. So I have the theme, but as far as how it comes together is absolutely, a chance operation, right? So I send emails out. I think I sent about 35 emails out to different individuals. These guys all got one saying, would you be interested in participating? And then, you know, if they are, they usually share with me what they'd like to do. And, you know, that's really how it comes together. So the purest form of collaboration, Greg.
Fantastic. We need to see more of that in the world, that's for sure. For those of you just joining us, we are talking about next week's third arts symposium taking place at Carthage, Peace, Parity, A New Cold War. And there will be a number of different events that occur next week, beginning with a musical event that we've already touched on briefly, a performance on Tuesday morning, that's the 14th of January, 11 a.m. in the Recital Hall, when a music colleague of mine, cellist Peter J. Thomas, with Jenny Yu at the piano, will be performing music of Sergei Prokofiev. And of course, Prokofiev, as many people know, is someone who actually left his native Russia because of the revolution, ultimately returned to the then Soviet Union in the mid-1930s, and continued to compose, but of course, within a very different cultural context than had once been in place, and had to find a way to be true to his own ideals while yet surviving under that kind of oppressive regime. And the ways in which Prokofiev managed to do that, and the way in which he managed to continue to create deeply compelling music under such circumstances is an extraordinary story in and of itself. So this symposium kicks off with this musical performance on Tuesday, January 14th. And then, as Leslie Brothers was saying, we have a screening that is a part of this symposium. And this will be a screening of a work of animation. And Joshua McGowan, who is assistant professor of art, is going to be hosting that, introducing it, and leading a discussion on that. Professor McGowan, it's great to have you with us. Tell us a little bit about this particular example of Soviet-era animation and why you think it promises to be a really compelling part of this event.
Absolutely, and thank you so much for having all of us on today. When Leslie reached out to me initially about if I would have any interest of screening animation from Soviet-era Russia for the symposium, I answered absolutely yes before I really had any recognition of what the event would fully encompass. And then not long after that, I received the titling information for the symposium, Peace, Parody, A New Cold War. And I thought, oh my goodness, this is much more profound than I had initially suspected. And looking at animations, the Soviet Union lasted for 69 years. There is a wealth, there's a massive discography of works to sift through. And running along that title line, initially, when I was researching what to show, there was a massive amount of turmoil and confusion that I was feeling within myself, not only looking at the works, specifically the works that are being selected for the gallery exhibition in the H.F. Johnson Gallery, but also considering that we're in a tumultuous time period. And many of the works of art that have been selected and many of the pieces that will be discussed during the symposium were works that were created during turmoil or during tumultuous time periods. The work, the screening of Tale of Tales by Yuri Norstein grapples with many of the themes that I believe we are currently experiencing today. Even though this particular screening of animation, this short film, its runtime is right under 30 minutes, specifically deals with factors of loss, not only personal and political loss after the conclusion of World War II, but also emotional devastation and economic devastation as well. And I believe that the first time I saw this piece, it tells a story in a non-linear trajectory. It's not chronological in any sense. The entire screening feels like a winding river that doesn't hesitate to disembark and travel down tributaries, and it seems much more to flow in a stream of consciousness to the way that people recall memories. And that structure in which Yuri Norstein decided to promote this piece of work, I believe really highlights this connecting theme that while time periods may change and while technology may change and how, and geopolitics, of course, change, in a world where there is a constant of war, the outcome, because even though the intention of the war may have been different, the outcome is always the same. It's devastation, loss, and a collective spirit to try to progress, understand, and move on. And that's what this piece, Tale of Tales, is trying to encompass. It does it through a really interesting lens because it's marketed as seemingly on the surface level, there are elements that feel like it should be themed for children because many of the themes are actually regaling Soviet-era folklore. And many of the characters involved in it have a certain visual sensibility that seems like it's tailored for children. But then there are other components, the more fragmented memory recall moments where it really disconnects from a chronological timeline that feel very much like they are intended for exclusively adult audiences. So it walks this really beautiful balance of not only being aesthetically pleasing, many of the visuals in the animation screening, because during this time period, animation was all analog processes. Everything was painted or drawn and then stitched together via photography. So many of the visual elements respond to the works that will be on display during the H.F. Johnson Gallery exhibition during a symposium, but also this piece shows how those traditional media can also be moved into a fourth dimension of time to really be able to expand on themes that were not only relevant at the time period, but also because of that that attachment to technology really seemed to allow this piece to speak volumes to the political atmospheres that we're facing today. That screening, just for a little bit of information, will be located in our VPAL gallery, which is right next to our H.F. Johnson Gallery. That's the Visual Performing Arts Lab. It's a beautiful space. And that will be taking place on January 15th from 1 to 3 p.m. So there'll be a great time for discussion. So if you feel like me about the event, when you walk through the H.F. Johnson Gallery and you're looking at these spectacular works of art that also have that weight of being aesthetically incredibly beautiful, but also having that contentious push and pull between not knowing how to feel in this political climate, then we step into the VPAL, we watch this piece, and we have a discussion that hopefully will provide, I don't know if I can even promise a sense of clarity, but at least maybe an opportunity to understand more about where these works are coming from, what the climate was when they were being made, and where they need to exist today in the canon of art history.
Right. By the way, I've watched some of this deeply intriguing film, and it has an animation technique that I'm not particularly familiar with, but that in and of itself I find quite remarkable. And I think you're right that at a very quick glance it might seem like something created with children in mind, and yet the themes are much more profound and mature than that. My understanding is that this animation, which is so visually arresting, is called cutout animation. Can you just briefly explain what that technique is about, and also if it's typical of this time and place?
Yes. So cutout animation now falls into a broad category of animation that we just called pixelation, which is any form of photography that has a stop motion interest. However, it doesn't extend into a third dimension. So a lot of times in a contemporary sense, when we think about stop motion, we think things like claymation, we think Tim Burton, we think of things that exist in a three-dimensional plane. Cutout animation is the exact same technological process. It's a bunch of photographs repeated over and over and over again. However, what the camera is being pointed at are two-dimensional traditional compositions. So oftentimes they are gouache paintings or charcoal on cold-pressed paper. Or oftentimes Yuri Norstein also used transfer paper and also a transparency film, so that way characters could move by simply having a character laid out on a piece of transparency on top of what basically amounts to a painting, to make it look like characters are being staged through a space without having to painstakingly go back and repaint all of those characters back into the original two-dimensional scene. So it is in a way, technologically speaking, for in a contemporary environment, a very easy technological process. The difficult thing about this form of animation is that you have to be a profoundly talented traditional media artist in order to create compositions, static media compositions, that can contain all of the emotional resonances that then are supposed to be translated into a fourth dimension. This piece took Yuri Norstein months and months to create, and he had a full production crew. In fact, he worked with a production studio out of Moscow that actually rejected two original titles for the piece, one which was a little bit too insensitive to the climate that he was experiencing for this piece's production, and then another that the studio thought targeted it much more too much to the lullaby inferences and the childlike sensibilities of it. And so I actually believe that Tale of Tales, the title that actually stuck with it, was sort of like a, all right, I've got two strikes against me already. I need to make this home run. I'm going to go with something that actually is a little bit safer in a way. And I think he landed on something perfect, because you hear Tale of Tales and you think, I don't really know what this is trying to provide to me. But then as you watch the piece, you realize that there is one very clear theme about the entire piece, and it is loss. But it explores that theme through so many almost seemingly independent sequences that start and then don't have a clear culmination or resolve, and then pick back up later after seemingly unrelated sequences. Mm. And then after the piece, that's when an audience, I believe, will start to recognize the smaller moments and the pieces that come together to reconnect to that larger theme of loss, and more specifically than that, how to make sense of calamity and how to move forward. Mm.
Joshua McGowan is going to be hosting this screening of this Soviet-era animation film called Tale of Tales. And again, that event will be next Wednesday, the 15th of January, 1 to 3 p.m. in Carthage's VPAL, which is immediately adjacent to the Johnson Art Gallery. For those of you just joining us today on The Morning Show, we're talking about next week's third art symposium at Carthage. This titled Peace Parity, A New Cold War. And there are various events occurring next Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Also on Wednesday, later after the screening, will be a presentation that is going to be introduced by Richard Meyer, who is professor of English and writer-in-residence at Carthage. Professor Meyer, I wonder if you would say a word about this very special guest who will be making this presentation on Wednesday evening.
Thanks, Greg. It's my pleasure. Yeah, when Leslie reached out to me, I immediately thought of Matvey Yankelevich, who's been a really central figure in American poetry as an editor, translator, and writer, and especially as the co-founder of Ugly Duckling Press and the Eastern Poets series, where he introduced a range of writers from Russia and Eastern Europe that had not been translated previously. He himself was born in Russia, came to Queens as a, I think, a 10 or 11-year-old, then ended up going back to Moscow after college before returning to Yale, where he eventually dropped out of the PhD program in Slavic Studies to found Ugly Duckling Press, to co-found it. And that press was interested, I think, and his talk will address a lot of these concerns, the ways that Eastern European poetry and modernist poetry had been narrowed and reduced in certain ways by the pressures of the Cold War to present those poets as, you know, heroes of the West and anti-Soviet and anti-communist. That was sort of the one aspect that put pressure on the way things were translated. And so to reintroduce poets and their sort of political, more complicated political relationship to that time. And in particular, he'll be speaking about Ossip Mandelstam and translations, new series of translations he's working on. And he says, I'll quote a little here, the translations during the Cold War were skewed by Western liberalism and Cold War antagonisms. So revisiting Mandelstam also means revisiting the context and history and trying to understand the positionality of someone who is working for a long time within the Soviet system and trying to find a way to honor his political commitments and also his nearly utopian cosmopolitan belief in a world culture, which many of the early revolutionary authors and artists shared. So I think, you know, when people see, for instance, Soviet art collection, I think there's a lot of assumptions about what that might be and how narrow that might be, and that things were either clear, sort of Western and anti-Soviet or sort of within that system, but that there's a lot of other places that art and writing existed. And we'll see the way a writer that was indeed, you know, executed by Stalin for writing a poem against him, but it wasn't simply that he was opposed to the utopian. He had his own utopian vision of a proletarian world culture united by art that was much closer to that revolutionary vision than Stalin, rather than being an anti-revolutionary position. So I'm fascinated to hear what somebody who's been steeped in publishing this work for so many years has to say about what we have maybe missed about some of these writers.
Right. Well, you're touching on something so intriguing, which is that on the one hand, a given literary work, whether it be poetry or whatever, is interesting in and of itself in terms of exactly what that writer intended to say. But then you are introducing into the mix this added layer of the translation and how something written, for instance, in the language of Russian, when it is translated, what decisions are made and what agendas are being pursued in the task of translation. And I think a lot of us amateurs on the outside looking in who know very little about that assume that the whole business of translation is quite cut and dried, that there is an objective clarity to it. And what you're suggesting is that it's a much murkier landscape, and particularly when we're talking about translation being done in politically sensitive environments and times.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, sometimes there's a presentation that poetry is either what can't be translated, and then an opposing view that poetry is in fact what survives translation. And I think there's enormous evidence from the very oldest writing we have that poetry very much survives translation. But that Matvey tells a story, for instance, about an English writer who was opposed to translation and submitted some 30 versions of a poem of Baudelaire's under various names to a contest for the best translation. And rather than sort of proving how you can't translate it, Matvey points out, the poem was present in all these versions, different aspects of it. So it's really the sort of a multiple nature of a great work of art and its ability to sort of exist in so many instantiations. A familiar example might be all the ways that Shakespeare has existed around the world and in various productions and seems to be able to, remain present to us in a certain way. And I think the other aspect of this, which is related maybe, is that American writing and American poetry has maybe been had traditionally an obsession with making itself distinct from English poetry and English literary history, and people like William Carlos Williams searching for a sort of American vernacular language and an American poetry, and the question of sort of what is American poetry. And so translation and translated writing has a funny relationship to American writing. And I think like one example of that would be Ugly Duckling Press that Matvey started in 2015, published 10% of all the poetry books that were translated in the United States. Wow. This is a small nonprofit poetry collective managing to, introduce so many writers, and often we get one or two writers from each country that represent, a particular vision that somebody has. So opening up the ways that the United States is part of world culture, and that art produced here is part of world culture, has a really interesting conversation to have with the idea of the Cold War, in which cultures were set against each other in certain ways. And I think, that's ongoing. There's a lot of fascinating discussions about how does one relate to the art and the writing of countries that are involved in conflict, and to not sort of judge them en masse. So right. I think it'll speak really interestingly into the political context and other things. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah. What you're saying brings to mind this whole matter of so often we look to the arts to kind of deepen and enrich our understanding of the world around us and each other. And what you're suggesting, though, is that sometimes art is used in a sense in exactly the opposite way. It can be used as a means of simplification, of boiling down, a whole complex culture into that's them and this is us. And it just seems like it's, in a sense, a misuse or a miscarriage of what art in its purest sense is meant to be.
Yeah, and I'm fascinated to hear and understand more about, for instance, how these paintings in the collection, a lot of which would have been sort of tarred with the brush of socialist realism, which is such a dismissive categorization as if that meant a single thing and meant that these artists were just, you know, pawns of the state. And I don't think that's the beginning and ending of this collection. And anybody that's looked at the painting, see, there's not a single style. There's not a single thing happening. So that's a connection that I think is really important. Yeah.
Again, this presentation by Matvey Yankelevich will be on Wednesday, the 15th, 6 to 7 p.m. in the VPAL, and Professor Richard Meyer will be introducing him and helping to lead a conversation. Speaking of conversation, a roundtable discussion will be taking place on Thursday afternoon. That's the 16th, and this will also be in the VPAL, I believe, and four different faculty members will be part of that conversation. Jerry Mast, Eric Poland, Paul Ulrich, and Gary Keller, who joins us. He is Associate Professor of Marketing and Management. And Professor Keller, one of the intriguing things about this roundtable discussion is that the publicity lists potential topics. And so clearly this is not a roundtable that has been, in a sense, sort of carefully scripted. I think the intention is for this discussion to kind of go wherever it's going to go. That being said, what do you anticipate being explored Thursday afternoon in this roundtable discussion?
As you mentioned, it hasn't been carefully scripted, so there'll be some interesting perspectives because I will bring the business perspective to it, and my other colleagues represent history, political science, and so forth. So they'll have a different perspective as well. When I was asked to participate, I took the perspective of answering the questions, because that's in the title, peace. Do we have peace? Or was there peace during the Cold War? Parity. What type of parity? And of course, I'm looking at it from the business standpoint, and a new Cold War, ? What I did was, to answer those questions, was trying to put things in perspective. Here's a couple. It's not all numbers, but the nature of the Cold War competition was ideology, one way of organizing society. And we've heard already some of the outcomes of a controlled economy and a controlled society. What do you get? There was also the military competition, geopolitical and economic. Let's go to the economic standpoint, which I'm most familiar with. The total GDPs, gross domestic products, which is really the accumulation of all of the goods, services that an economy generates. In 1991, very shortly after the fall of the Soviet Union, the United States, $6.1 trillion, number one. Number two was Japan, $3.6 trillion. And many viewers and listeners will remember at one point it was forecast that Japan would overtake the United States in terms of GDP. And I believe that forecast was 1990. The Russian Federation, $518 billion. That number is very, very important. They were ranked number nine, and that included not just the country of Russia, but many of its former satellites that broke off and went their own way. Number 10. China at $413 billion. Important little perspective there. At that point, California, just the state of California as it does today, in 2024, for instance, its GDP is about $3.9 trillion, which puts it only behind the United States, China, Germany, and Japan. And then if you look at what does that generate to the average citizen? California has a GDP per capita greater than all of the countries following the United States in total. So when I looked at the situation, I started to say, ask, peace. Was there peace during the Cold War? Big picture. There were periodic political and military flashes between the two dominant powers at that time, the United States and Russia. Remember, some of the Berlin crises. Who can ever forget the Cuban Missile Crisis? And there were a lot of proxy wars, but there was no major state-on-state hot war that took place. That was assured to a great extent by a term that I'll come back to, mutual assured destruction. When you have significant numbers of not only nuclear weapons, but the ability to deliver them, there is a situation that compels individuals to restrain themselves. There's other ways of competing then. A social system that may look appealing to some, but also an economic system. Was there parity? There was rough military parity between the United States and the Soviet Union at that time. However, it came at a tremendous cost. With a small economy that Russia had, I think the number was 20% of its GDP was relegated to military expenditures. Ours may have been 2 to 4%, but look at the size difference. As a result of that ongoing competition in that regard, the Soviet Union's economy imploded on its own in 1989, not to mention corruption that took place, among other things. So it was a failed ideology. It just didn't catch on. And as my colleagues have talked about, look what it did to artistic expression, freedom of expression, and we're going to see a parallel to this today. If you don't have that type of creative economy, it's very difficult to develop the next generation of, you name it, to push things forward. That is another nuance that's lost. Jumping to 2024, once again, to put a lot of things in perspective. GDP for the United States this past year, $29.17 trillion. Number two, China, which was forecast again to overtake the United States, I think, by 2020 in terms of GDP. Now, economists and others will argue there's all sorts of ways of trying to calculate those things. Let's just stick to what we have used for many, many years. Number two, as I said, is the Chinese economy at $18.27 trillion. Russia, standing alone now, and we're going back to comparing the principal opponents during the Cold War. At number 11, Russia, $2.18 trillion. That's just slightly ahead of the Mexican economy. Here's a couple other numbers. Interest rates right now in Russia are 23%. And an inflation rate of 9%. Individuals listening to the show and others realize there's ways you can get by without saving, without reinvesting. It's called a charge card. You charge now, you're going to pay it later, and there's a huge interest rates and huge interest rate, and it also causes inflation. Sooner or later, you have to pay for that. It's an interesting question that Russian leaders will have to deal with. Jumping now to compare the final question. Now in 2024, do we have a new Cold War? The nature of the classic Cold War that we discussed had to do with primarily an ideology of how one arranges a society and controls it. This one now is a new one. And I'm not saying Cold War. It's a competition of cultures of commerce, geoeconomic, geopolitical, and finally, I'm calling it MAED, mutual assured economic destruction. Considering the nature of the supply chain, how many industries and so forth have been outsourced throughout the world. It's complicated. It's interconnected. So that, I think, is the key competition right now. And there's ways of arranging economies, but it's capitalism that dominates. But you can have pure capitalism as we understand it. You can also have mixed form of capitalism, very similar to what the Chinese have, or you can go North Korea and have total control over an economy, really a Stalin, an updated Stalin system. So the competition is interesting because one can say, well, what do the Chinese have to offer? Here's some other facts. In 1978, their GDP was $149.5 billion. Deng Xiaoping opened up the economy. California's economy, their GDP in 1978, was $263 billion. One state in the United States had a greater GDP and economic performance than an entire country. Fast forward now, 35 years later, China, number two, with the GDP in the world. That's stunning. That's something that they can say, look what we did in 35 years using our system compared to, let's say, the United States system, Western European, and so forth. So they're offering those types of choices, and when you watch the news, take a look at the types of development projects they're sponsoring around the world, around the world. So China can say, look, you don't have to have a pure democratic system to make economic progress, and of course share that with the population. There's that competition that's going on. And the other thing is the restructuring that is hopefully, depends on who you're looking at, that's also taking place. After World War II, the United States led efforts to create these stabilizing institutions, the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, to help regulate the competition that was going to take place. In other words, if we're going to compete, let's have rules. That ironically helped the People's Republic of China to compete and become number two in the world in terms of economic productivity. And now both China and Russia, and among, there's some others as well, want to try to reset the rules. That's going to be a very, very interesting format and in how it's going to work out. Nonetheless, if you put all of the BRIC, B-R-I-C, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, if you combine all of those economies right now, they're still less than the United States alone. I've got the numbers here.
That's remarkable. Yeah,
it is remarkable, and here's one other thing that that's taking place, and it's reinforcing what my other colleague said. Why is the United States continuing to be able to increase its economy? Simply because we have a free, open culture, a free, open society that promotes creativity, that promotes innovation, and tolerates failure. There's always dissent about that, but when you take a look at the numbers, they're very compelling. And then finally, there's one other thing that to be aware of, and that is the emergence of stateless mega corporations that transcends borders. Who's in charge of them? The other thing is the emergence of, I can't come up with a good adjective. I would have to rely on my colleagues to come up with a better adjective. But when you get individuals that are as wealthy as entire economies, I just saw one person valued at $400 billion. I could run the numbers a little bit further, but that's probably the size of several individual countries. How are they going to be integrated into this competition? What role do they have? Are they, rogue in a sense? So those are some of the things that I looked at. And is there a new Cold War? I would say no. There's a different type of competition that's taking place. culture of commerce.
It's fascinating, and that and more is going to be explored in this roundtable discussion Thursday afternoon in the VPAL. Professor Keller is one of just four faculty who will be participating, also Jerry Mast, Eric Pullen, and Paul Ulrich, bringing in the disciplines of political science and history to further enrich this exploration. Leslie Brothers, let's finish with you with a quick word of the culminating event, which will take place right after that roundtable discussion, the official reception and opening of this exhibition, this particular portion of this massive collection of Soviet art, and this particular subset of the collection, if you will, called Visions Behind the Veil, which explores portraiture. Just say a quick word about the significance of this choice for the symposium.
Oh, sure. So, you know, the exhibition is kind of the nucleus, right? And everyone so beautifully made those connections to the complexity of the arts, cultural in general, of this time period. So we're inviting viewers on a compelling journey into Soviet portraiture, where the veils of political ideology often obscured deeper layers of human experience, as Rick mentioned, and others. We're looking at artistic resilience and how Soviet artists navigated the constraints of state censorship while striving to capture the essence of their subjects. So there are performers, poets, cultural icons represented in this particular collection of portraits. I want to say quickly that next door in the Hedberg Library, there are 12 paintings on extended loan that are examples. Some are examples of the portraits that were more generic workers, field hands, you know, rather than people who had cultural significance or were friends of the artists that painted the portraits. Hmm.
So a view of the ordinary, if you will, which can in and of itself be so beautiful and compelling. It's important for us to underscore that all of these events we've been talking about are open to the public and also completely free of charge. And do you feel like it's important for people to take in everything as much as possible, or can one pick and choose and still have a really meaningful experience?
Oh my gosh. Well, from the descriptions of each one of these events today, you know, in this program, I think you could get a whole lot from attending just one, but I would highly recommend trying to experience as many of them as possible. Great. Hmm.
And for more information, where can people go on the Carthage website?
Right. So www.carthage.edu. And if you just put in Soviet art, simply enough, it'll give you everything that's happening connected to the symposium and more information on each event.
Excellent. Leslie Brothers is visiting assistant professor and managing of the gallery programs at Carthage right now. Also with us today, Gary Keller, associate professor of marketing and management, Joshua McGowan, assistant professor of art, and Richard Meyer, professor of English and writer in residence, all participating in next week's third art symposium, celebrating Carthage's Samuel and Barry Schoen collection of Soviet art with an event titled Peace, Parity, A New Cold War. Thank you to all of you for being part of this conversation, and very best wishes to all of you as this academic year proceeds.
Thanks, Greg.
Thanks
everyone.
Greg.
And tomorrow on the morning show, the interview that was to air today with Beth Bush, talking about the production at the Racine Theater Guild of Over the River and Through the Woods, which opens this coming Friday. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. Today will be a mostly sunny day, a little chilly with a high of 26 degrees. Speaking of chilly, the overnight low will be 10 above. Partly sunny again tomorrow and a high of just 22 degrees. Thursday looks like sunshine and a high of 29. We do show in the extended forecast a chance of some light snow on Friday. And daytime highs will continue to be in the low to mid 20s. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine.